Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
June's Journey is a fascinating hidden object mystery gaming app where you'll play as June Parker, tasked with a daunting obligation: solve your sister's murder. Set in the 1920s, the era of glitz and glam, this family mystery is one for the ages. Everyone's a suspect until your investigation determines otherwise. The clues are all around you, hidden within tricky twists and turns. You'll collect detailed information about each character in your photo album, where you'll comb over every detail. You can even join a detectives club to chat and play with others or against them in the detectives league. With hundreds of puzzles to solve, you should probably get started today. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
Mike and I had been there about 3 hours in the morning, and our goal for that day, that first day, was to identify and photograph all the men in the group. At about 10:30, the local Afghan commander said there were about 20 men left to see, and they were still in the cellar. And apparently they didn't want to come up out of the cellar. Well, apparently they did have weapons on their person, and they hid those weapons on themselves. They used them when they were coming up the stairs, and they shot the Afghan personnel that were trying to take the weapons away from them. And that's when it all started. The uprising started there. Some of the prisoners came for me. I started to shoot them. I moved eventually to Mike, and I found him covered with four of the Al-Qaeda guys. And Mike was dead at this point. I took his rifle, and with his rifle and my pistol, I began to fire again. And over the course of about 17 minutes, I fired about 100 rounds. Wow. It was very intense combat, very close quarters combat, and sometimes these guys were just feet away when they were shooting at me and I was shooting at them. It was just crazy. If you can remember those opening and closing scenes of Saving Private Ryan, the movie, mm-hmm. when Private Ryan, as an old man, visits the cemetery and the grave of the sergeant who saved his life, he struggles with that idea of sacrifice and his being the survivor. And I guess, at least for me, all one can do is try to be a better person and always remember the honor and sacrifice made by people like Mike and many, many others.
David Tyson was, until recently, a paramilitary officer at the Central Intelligence Agency. He was one of the first CIA officers into Afghanistan after 9/11. And he was with the first casualty of that war, Mike Spann, when Mike was killed in action on November 25th, 2001. As part of our spy story series, I just sat down with David to talk about his career, his time in Afghanistan, and that terrible moment in November 19 years ago today. We'll be right back with that conversation after a quick word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters Declassified, spy stories from the officers who were there.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
David, thank you for joining us for the next episode in our Intelligence Matters Declassified series. It is great to have you on the show. Welcome. So this episode is, I think, going to be a bit of a tough one because it's the story of an agency officer, Mike Spann, who was the first American killed in combat in the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11. And it's going to be especially tough because you, David, were there with Mike when he was lost. So thank you, you know, very much for doing this. I know it's not easy.
Okay. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
David, let's start with your story pre-9/11. How did you come to work at CIA?
Well, I was born and raised in a town in Pennsylvania. And after high school, I enlisted in the Army. And I used the GI Bill after the Army to go to college. And at college, I started taking Russian, the language, and I just loved it. I became obsessed with it, and I just wanted to do Russian. But I graduated, then went back into the Army, became an officer, and got out, and then went to graduate school. And in graduate school, I studied Central Asian languages like Uzbek and Turkmen. And while teaching in grad school, I became aware of CIA careers, and I applied and got a job.
When was that?
That was in 1996 when I was first hired. And I started out as a translator using those languages, Uzbek, Turkmen, and Russian. But I transferred into the Directorate of Operations.
Did you go right to the paramilitary side of things, or did you kind of work your way there?
No, actually, I did not go into the PM field at all. I just became a line case officer, and my first assignment was in Central Asia, where I spent all told about 10 years living out there, and I had my family out there with me.
So, David, where were you on 9/11 when you heard about what happened?
Well, just prior to 9/11, or in the couple of years prior to 9/11, I was in Central Asia with my family on a tour, and we had some experience going to Afghanistan and with Afghan issues. And using my languages, some of the languages of Afghanistan. So I was in Central Asia when 9/11 happened. And when that took place, it became clear, at least to most of us, what was going to happen next. And that was that we would go back into Afghanistan for me. And the agency quickly made plans to be the first government entity deployed to the country after 9/11, and I was selected to go on one of the teams.
Did you come back to Washington first before going to Afghanistan, or did you go right from where you were in Central Asia?
Right from Central Asia. No, I did not go back to the headquarters area, and I waited for the team to get there.
So you went into Afghanistan with the team from where you were?
Right, right. And,
was Mike with you then?
Yeah, he and his team came out to Central Asia and to prepare for our deployment. And our team of eight men flew into Central Asia, into Afghanistan, I'm sorry, on two U.S. Special Operations Black Hawk helicopters. And Mike was a member of that team, obviously.
David, did you know him before all of this?
Yeah, I knew Mike, and he had deployed to Central Asia a couple times before, and there we worked together on counter-terrorist issues. He was a paramilitary officer, and thanks to his background as a Marine, he took part in the training of foreign special forces troops. And like me, he had a wife and young children, and we both just had started our careers at CIA, basically. He was from Alabama. He was a patriot. He was very serious about his work. He was very meticulous, and he was very professional. He always had the mission at the forefront of his mind, but he was kind of quiet and had a dry but very good sense of humor. He was a true warrior, and he became a friend as well.
So you two are working together in Afghanistan after 9/11. What's your job?
Well, our team of eight men, we had a so-called warlord to work with. His name was Abdul Rashid Dostum. He was ethnic Uzbek, and he had a force under his command that was fighting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And Dostum and his Uzbeks were more or less cavalrymen. That's how they did their war fighting. Commander Dostum was an excellent commander, a tactician, and partner for us. And thanks to my language skills, I got to work with him pretty closely. And soon after we arrived, we facilitated the insertion of a U.S. Army Special Forces team, ODA, Operational Detachment Alpha 595. They were a great group of guys, and we together, meaning the Afghan Uzbeks and the other Afghans and our team and the Green Beret team, quickly became a really formidable and effective fighting force. One unexpected problem for us was that we had to ride horses almost every day. And believe me, we weren't prepared for that. And this was under combat conditions a lot of times, and for many hours a day in some cases. And very few of us had ridden horses before. So we also had to become combat cavalrymen as well. And while we did ride the horses, we could no way, of course, compare to the Afghan Uzbek fighters who had basically been born and raised on horseback. They routinely conducted cavalry charges against the enemy and fired, for example, their machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades while charging. It was just incredible to witness this. I was constantly in awe of them and their toughness, their skills. And these guys became great partners for us. And I have to say, the pain and suffering and fear I experienced while on horseback was also often kind of intense. And most of the time I dreaded riding. Now I feel kind of nostalgic for it. And I should also note that the Green Beret team that we brought into Afghanistan and worked with was featured in that movie 12 Strong. We were with them the whole way, but our team was not depicted in the movie, of course, really. The SF team was extremely well-led and effective. It was a great group of guys. And by early 2001, we had made great progress. And after a lot of combat, intense combat, south of the city called Mazar-e-Sharif, these Afghan forces we were with and us, we entered the city of Mazar.
And what happened there?
Mike and I had been working a lot together, and our job, well, it was multifaceted, but we mostly worked with our Afghan partners, our Afghan Uzbek partners, to learn about the situation and gather information, threat information. We also spoke with captured and surrendered enemy fighters. Mike had the task of setting up drop zones for the weapons and supplies that were parachuted in on a nightly basis. And towards the end of November, we got information that a large number of Al-Qaeda fighters were to surrender and arrive in Mazar-e-Sharif, the city we were in, on 23 or 24 November. And we spoke to our headquarters, and as expected, we were ordered to learn as much as we could from these guys, these prisoners, these Al-Qaeda men, and who they are, what they were up to, and what they might know about past and future terrorist acts. At the time, this was the largest and only, really, group of Al-Qaeda personnel to whom we had access. And it was understood, and it turned out to be true, that many in the group had attended Al-Qaeda trading camps and had learned, for example, about poisons, chemical warfare, and other terrorist tactics and activities.
So, David, were they in a prison facility, or physically, where were you with them?
Well, they surrendered, and that's the word I'll use. They surrendered one evening, 24 November, I believe, and they were taken by these Afghan Uzbeks to a fort called Kalai Jangi. It was on the outskirts of Mazar-e-Sharif, and there they were put into a building, the cellar of a building. And you have to understand, back there, back in Afghanistan at the time, there were no lights, there was no electricity, there were really no facilities, and at night it was a very difficult situation to do all this. And these guys were basically put into this cellar with the idea that the next day, on 25 November, we could interview them and figure out who they were and what they were up to.
So what, David, what was a typical interview like? You get one of these guys and you sit them down. What was it like?
The interviews on 25 November were brief. These guys were being brought out of the cellar one by one. Their hands were tied behind their back using their turbans. And I was immediately impressed by the fact that there were so many languages and countries represented by these prisoners, so-called prisoners. And the languages were just incredible. I spoke several languages of the region, but these prisoners were from all over the world, not only the Muslim world, but the world in general. We took possession of their documents, took photos, and as possible, we had brief conversations as to who they were and where they were from and what they were doing in Afghanistan. And most of them spoke openly, I would say, about their identities, their ties to Al-Qaeda, and their basic desire to conduct what they considered jihad. Some of them, of course, lied and didn't say much, but for the most part, they were talkative. But we just had so many people, up to 400 guys to go through. There was not much time to deal with individual prisoners.
So you and Mike interviewed an American citizen that day, fighting for the Taliban, John Walker Lind. What was that like? Did you know he was an American when you talked to him?
No, we did not. And there were several European-looking people among these Al-Qaeda prisoners. And one of them was John Walker Lind. We, of course, at the time didn't know who he was or where he was from. He, unlike most of the other prisoners, refused to say anything. I tried all my languages on him. But he did not even utter a word. And we spoke in English to him as well. And again, we went away from that. We spent a few moments with him and he refused to speak. We sort of went on to other things. And we never knew that day that he was an American.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Then we'll be right back with more of our discussion with David Tyson.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So David, how long were you and Mike at the fort before things went south? And can you tell us that story?
Sure. Mike and I had been there about 3 hours in the morning. And our goal for that day, that first day, was to identify and photograph all the men in the group. At about 10:30, the local Afghan commander said...
10:30 in the morning, right?
Yeah, 10:30 in the morning. The local Afghan commander said there were about 20 men left to see, and they were still in the cellar. And apparently they didn't want to come up out of the cellar. And it was assumed that they were trying not to be identified. So we decided, Mike and I decided, to wait until all these guys came up from the basement of the building. However, prior to that, there was a lot of gunfire that erupted in this building, in the cellar area, and explosions took place as well in this area near the basement.
So where'd the weapons come from?
Well, apparently they did have weapons on their person, and they hid those weapons on themselves the night before. So they had those weapons and they used them when they were coming up the stairs, and they shot the Afghan personnel that were trying to take the weapons away from them. And that's when it all started. The uprising started there.
And where was Mike and where were you when this happened, and what happened to Mike?
Well, Mike was in a different area. He was talking to some prisoners that were being treated medically by some Afghan doctors that we had called in. And Mike was amongst those prisoners, and I was a little further out with an individual talking to him. And as that gunfire and explosions, as they continued, the local guard force and the prisoners began to move and attack each other. And a lot of people started running away. It was very chaotic. Some of the prisoners came for me, and I started to shoot them, and I moved eventually to Mike, and I found him covered with four of the Al-Qaeda guys, and Mike was dead at this point, and I took his rifle, and with his rifle and my pistol, I began to fire again. And over the course of about 17 minutes, I fired about 100 rounds.
Wow.
And with my pistol and Mike's rifle. It was very intense combat, very close quarters combat. And sometimes these guys were just feet away when they were shooting at me and I was shooting at them. It was just crazy.
Did you have body armor on?
No body armor. This is right after 9/11. The idea of body armor was not really current at the time. We had no body armor, no.
And in terms of cover, you're out in the open?
Yeah, we were in the open. This was an open area in the southern compound, except for the building, basically, and some vehicles. And I was running around, and they were running around. And again, it was very strange. I was shooting at them. They were shooting at me. Two grenades hit me, for example, one in the thigh and one in my chest. Neither exploded. And again, it was very chaotic. And as soon as the gunfire started, I remember very clearly now that I lost my sense of hearing. Things moved in slow motion. I lost my peripheral vision. And I thought very, very quickly. Thoughts were coming in and out of my mind very, very fast, at fractions of a second. And I knew at the time this was happening to me. I mean, this strange and weird process. I was not thinking normally, and I was on some kind of autopilot. It was not normal.
So you knew at this point that Mike hadn't made it, and boy, you're in the thick of things. Did you think this was it for you or not?
I don't think so. No, I can't say I remember thinking that I was going to die. I was in a state of amazement, I would say, just trying to comprehend what was going on and what I was doing and what they were trying to do to me. Again, it was very strange. Fear was not part of the equation. It's not because I was being brave. It was simply because fear, I guess, had no place right then for me. I was certainly sort of on some kind of high of adrenaline, obviously, or something like that. But it was a very strange situation. I can't account even today for all those 17 minutes I was down in that southern compound.
So, David, how did you get out of there?
I just kept moving north towards this entrance of the southern compound. And at the northern part of the fort, the northern compound, I knew was where the other Afghan forces were, the friendly Afghan forces. And I made my way through a open field, just ran through this open area to the northern compound. And from there, we continued to fire upon the Al-Qaeda forces, who by this time, they had taken control of a large amount of small arms and mortars, and they were using those weapons against us. And this firing and shooting and killing continued for about 4 more hours. And quick reaction force of U.S. and British military arrived to assist me and Mike. And they called in airstrikes, and they laid down a large amount of machine gun fire, small arms fire on the enemy. But it was still determined by them that they couldn't rescue me, as it were. And they told me to try to escape, which I was later able to do. I climbed out over the wall of the fort, slid down the wall with some other friendlies, and got back to my base.
When were they able to recover Mike's body?
It took a long time. It took several days, actually. Mike was killed outright in the initial moments of the uprising. But since I was not able to get back to his body, and given my own situation of being out of communications for several hours during the fighting, we initially, Mike and myself, were considered to be missing. And it took about 3 more days of going back to the fort each day and assaulting the enemy positions within the fort using our Afghan forces and U.S. military assets until we got Mike's body. We'd made many assaults into the southern compound, and for us, at least our group, our team, our only purpose at that time was to get Mike's body out of there. And his body was found exactly where he had fallen. And we took possession of his body, and after a few more days, I accompanied his body to U.S. military bases out of the country.
Did you stay in Afghanistan after that, or did you come home?
I stayed for a while, and then eventually I came back to eventually I came back out and met my family and so forth. But I deployed again to Afghanistan repeatedly, several times, and in that part of the world again.
David, back in Washington, I was President Bush's daily intelligence briefer, and George Tenet, then the director of the agency, and I briefed the president on what happened to you and Mike. The president wanted to know every detail. He actually read the very detailed cable that had been prepared on what happened. And when he got to the end of it, he asked George Tenet about Mike's family. And George told the president about Mike's wife, Shannon, and the kids. And the president looked at his chief of staff, Andy Card, and said, "I want to call Shannon today." Kind of remarkable how these two things come together. David, you've been incredible with your time. Let me just ask a couple more questions. I'm just wondering if, I know this is a tough question, if you ever felt guilty that you were the one to have made it.
Well, yes, of course, certainly. That was something, or it is something, that I think about very often, that whole question of death and survival. You know, Mike had 3 young children at the time. Now they're young adults. He had a wife. He had loving parents. And their loss is forever. And what Mike could have done with his life, that's all gone as well. So for me, I try to use his memory in a way so that I might be a better person, is sort of cliche that might sound. And if you do remember, or if you can remember that those opening and closing scenes of Saving Private Ryan, the movie, mm-hmm. when Private Ryan, as an old man, visits the cemetery and the grave of the sergeant who saved his life, he struggles with that idea of sacrifice and his being the survivor. And I guess, at least for me, all one can do is try to be a better person and always remember the honor and sacrifice made by people like Mike and many, many others.
David, I think a lot of people who might have gone through what you went through might have thrown in the towel, might have left CIA, left the government, but you didn't. You stayed. Did you ever think about leaving, and why did you stay?
No, I never thought about leaving at all. It was not a sort of option. The people in the agency, the support we received, myself and my family, those things, and this is prior to the deployment, after the deployment, that all made the agency my home. I, with my family, we stayed out in the field for an additional 8 years in that region, and it never really entered my mind that I would leave. I went back to Afghanistan, as we talked about a few more times, and now there's no regrets, none whatsoever. And I stress that the agency now and then, I believe, is filled with quality, good people. And that's what made the difference for me, I think.
David, I want to let our listeners know that the loss of Mike Spann led some former agency officers to create a charity to help take care of the educational needs of the children of our officers who are lost in the line of duty. It's called the CIA Officers Memorial Fund. There's also another fund to help CIA officers and their families in broader ways for officers who serve in war zones. This is called the Third Option Foundation. I would encourage my listeners to Google both of them and to decide if they want to make a donation. David, thank you for joining us, and thank you for helping us tell Mike's story and your own story. And most important, thank you for your service to your country over a long period of time, but in those crucial early days in Afghanistan after 9/11. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. I hope that people do look at those things that you talked about regarding Mike and his memory, and I hope things go well.
That was David Tyson. Please join us next week for another regular episode of our show. I'm Michael Morrell.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ariana Freeman. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.